This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, 100 years of Robert Duncan. Robert Duncan was born in 1919 in Oakland, California. In 1941, he was drafted, then discharged after coming out as gay. He was one of the first big American literary figures to openly acknowledge his homosexuality. But that's probably not what keeps his poetry in circulation these days. Duncan was an important part of both the Black Mountain School of Poetry and the San Francisco Renaissance. His poems were sometimes arcane, sometimes political, always experimental, and always deeply felt. 2019 is the centenary of Robert Duncan's birth, so he'll no doubt be on the literary radar this year. A few years ago, the first major biography of Duncan came out. The author was the poet Lisa Jarnot, and in 2012, I spoke with her about why Duncan was so important to her. I began by asking how she found her way to Duncan's poetry.
My first love in poetry was, I was a beatnik. So I started off with Allen Ginsberg and Lawrence Ferlinghetti and Jack Kerouac and that crowd. And when I got to Duncan, I found out that I couldn't read the poems. I didn't know what was happening in the poems. The poems were incredibly dense. I think the first book of his I ever took out of the library was called Roots and Branches. And I thought, well, maybe this is just nature poetry, which I was very opposed to. It started off as a challenge, and then he became a model for me who was really different than the Beats.
So he was associated with the Beats, but never really a part of them. He was part of the San Francisco scene, but never really a part of the San Francisco scene. How would you characterize his poetry, though?
Well, he characterized it as romantic, meditative, 17th century metaphysical.
Yeah.
It's a lot of things, though. So.
It's highly romantic. It's highly intense poetry and very charged. And there's nothing laconic about Robert Duncan.
Yeah. But there is a base in the Black Mountain School. You know, Duncan called himself a derivative poet. He had a big ego. He thought of himself as joining the company of Dante and Whitman and Shelley and Blake and Shakespeare.
And in conversation with them, basically.
And in conversation with them, yeah.
So we're going to listen to two poems by Robert Duncan. One's very short and one's much longer. The first one, the short one, is called Childhood's Retreat. And it's about a child building a fort up in a tree, basically. That's the central image in it. What else do we need to know about this poem?
This is a poem to listen to the meter and to listen to the internal rhyme, because this is one of the poems where Duncan is really a master, where he's working off of, you know, a writer like Shakespeare. Ezra Pound talked about the tone leading of vowels. You'll hear a melody within in there.
Okay, let's listen to it. Here's Robert Duncan reading Childhood's Retreat.
It's in the perilous branches of the tree, out of blue sky, the wind sings loudest surrounding me, and solitude, a wild solitude, is revealed. Fearfully high I'd climb into the shaking uncertainties of song, part out of longing, part daring myself, part to see that widening of the world, part to find my own, my secret hiding sense and place, where from afar all voices and scenes come back, the barking of a dog, autumnal burnings, far calls, close calls, the boy I was calls out to me, here the man where I am, look, I've been where you most fear to be.
Well, tell me about the vowels that you mentioned, what he's doing with vowels and the music of this poem.
First of all, there's this funny rhyme.
Surrounding me.
Uncertainties. This, I think you could probably push the lines into a sonnet form. It's a little bit longer than a sonnet.
It's in the perilous branches of the tree, out of blue sky, the wind sings loudest surrounding me.
We've got straight rhyme there, tree, me, that's your end rhyme.
And solitude, a wild solitude, is revealed. Fearfully High I'd climb into the shaking uncertainties of song.
Here's your internal rhyme. He's running it on this I sound. High climb sky.
Part out of longing, part daring myself, part to see that widening of the world, part to find my own, my secret hiding sense and place.
Hiding, you see?
Mm-hmm.
This is composition by field. So the field of the poem is no longer the narrative. The field there is the field of the eye sound.
Mm-hmm.
And it is like a painting where you would have blue on one corner and blue on another. You have climb and hiding. They're not that close to each other, but they're there, and they bounce off of each other.
Mm-hmm.
If you were playing a piece on the piano and you hit a C note on the bottom of the keyboard, and then later you hit a C note higher up, the lower note's still resonating against the higher note, right?
Well, just backing up, just on a literal level, without even considering the sounds, there is a narrative structure to it. This is a boy climbing mm-hmm. up into a mm-hmm. tree, into a hideout into the tree,
mm-hmm.
and taking in the world around him. Some of it's close up.
The barking of a dog.
Right.
Some of it's far away.
Autumnal burnings, far calls, close calls.
So it does make sense. Narratively, it does have a narrative structure to it. It's,
mm-hmm,
it's not
mm-hmm.
just a field of sound.
Right, it's both. I mean, this is what makes for a great poem.
Mm.
You know, anyone can write a poem about climbing a tree. Many people have written poems about climbing a tree, right? Many people have written poems about trees, etc. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But what makes it interesting, right? Tree poems can be really boring.
So what makes this one interesting to you?
It is partly the way that he turns it into a musical composition. Partly the form of the piece, that it mimics a sonnet, but he's broken it apart, so it's not really a sonnet. He's showing his reverence to that form, but he's letting it climb or move or sway, and that's interesting to me.
It's also a challenge to the adult poet. The boy is climbing into the shaking uncertainties of song,
mm-hmm.
which is what any poet worth his salt wants to do.
Right.
You want to climb into places where you don't know exactly what you're doing. And the boy is saying at the very end of the poem, look.
Look, I've been where you most fear to be.
There's a sort of mocking of the adult poet writing this poem. There's a certain challenge
right.
inherent there. Don't
right.
you? No?
Yeah. Well, yeah, no, I think... I'm trying to think of what Duncan would say about that, and I have the feeling that he would have so much to say about it in so many different directions that to just pinpoint that line and to try to do the kind of high school what does it mean thing,
mm-hmm.
it would make him kind of antsy. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. let's go to the other poem. It's much longer, and it's what you said. It's one of his most popular poems. My mother would be a falconress, it's called, and he takes that metaphor and runs with it through the entire poem. Tell us a little bit about this poem and help set it up for us.
This poem is written during the Vietnam War, late 60s. It's anthologized a lot, and I think mostly because it's one of Duncan's poems that has a sense of traditional narrative. It's inspired partly by his readings of William Blake, and it's also comes out of a dream.
One of his dreams.
One of his dreams,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
This is a longer poem, but it's very clear, and unfortunately, in the reading we're about to hear, he reads a little too fast, but I don't think that's a problem because it's not overly complicated for listeners to follow along. Let's listen to it. This is My Mother Would Be a Falconress by Robert Duncan.
My mother would be a falconress, and I, her gay falcon, treading her wrist, would fly to bring back from the blue of the sky to her, bleeding a prize, where I dream in my little hood with many bells jangling when I turn my head. My mother would be a falconress, and she sends me as far as her will goes. She lets me ride to the end of her curb, where I fall back in anguish. I dread that she will cast me away, for I fall, I mistake. I fail in her mission. She would bring down the little birds, and I would bring down the little birds. When will she let me bring down the little birds, pierced from their flight with their necks broken, their heads like flowers limp from the stem? I tread my mother's wrist and would draw blood. Behind the little hood, my eyes are hooded. I have gone back into my hooded silence, talking to myself and dropping off to sleep. For she has muffled my dreams in the hood she has made me, sewn round with bells, jangling when I move. She rides with her little falcon upon her wrist. She uses a barb that brings me to cower. She sends me abroad to try my wings, and I come back to her. I would bring down the little birds to her. I may not tear into. I must bring back perfectly. I tear at her wrist with my beak to draw blood, and her eye holds me, anguish terrifying. She draws a limit to my flight, never beyond my sight, she says. She trains me to fetch and to limit myself in fetching. She rewards me with meat for my dinner, but I must never eat what she sends me to bring her. Yet it would have been beautiful if she would have carried me always in the little hood with the bells ringing at her wrist and her riding to the great falcon hunt and me flying up to the curb of my heart from her heart to bring down the skylark from the blue to her feet, straining and then released for the flight. My mother would be a falconress, and I heard your falcon raised at her will from her wrist sent flying as if I were her own. Pride, as if her pride knew no limits, as if her mind sought in me flight beyond the horizon. Ah, but high, high in the air I flew, and far, far beyond the curb of her will were the blue hills with the falcon's nest. And then I saw west to the dying sun. It seemed my human soul went down in flames. I tore at her wrist at the hold she had for me until the blood ran hot, and I heard her cry out far, far beyond the curb of her will, to horizons of stars beyond the ringing hills of the world where the falcon's nest I saw. And I tore at her wrist with my savage beak. I flew as if sight flew from the anguish in her eye beyond her sight, sent from my striking loose and the cruel strike at her wrist, striking out from the blood to be free of her. My mother would be a falconress, and even now, years after this, when the wounds I have left her had surely healed and the woman is dead, her fierce eyes closed, and if her heart were broken, it is stilled. I would be a falcon and go free. I tread her wrist and wear the hood, talking to myself, and would draw blood.
Now, you're Robert Duncan's biographer.
You're right.
One can't help but see the Oedipal background in this poem. How does it fit in with his life, or does it at all? Is this something you can dismiss, or is it something that fits in with the poet's relationship with his mother?
Oh, it does. It does very much fit in with mm-hmm. his relationship with his mother. He's writing about his adoptive mother here. His biological mother died in childbirth. He was adopted into a family of theosophists. His mother and his adoptive parents were part of a hermetic brotherhood in Oakland, California.
Mm-hmm.
His adoptive mother was Minnehaha Sims. She was a socialite.
Mm-hmm.
She and her husband adopted Duncan based on his astrological chart. And they told him that they had adopted him because of his bad karma. They adopted a daughter who had good karma.
Oh, my God.
She wasn't a terrible mother. She loved books. She read to him. She loved poetry. They had enough money to get through the Depression. When I met Duncan's sister, she thought that her mom was really great. So Duncan, he had a troubled relationship with her. Partly, there are a couple things here. He was homosexual, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's right here in the poem.
My mother would be a falconress, and I, her gay falcon, treading her wrist.
She didn't seem to have trouble with that so much, and it may actually have been part of the prediction based on his astrological chart that he would be deviant in this way, right?
Mm-hmm.
The chart also, according to his parents, showed that he had his last incarnation in Atlantis, and that he had been part of a generation that had destroyed their own world, right? Mm-hmm. And that he had been brought back for the end times now, right, which would be some fiery ending, probably atomic.
He grew up with that story.
That was in his head growing up, right?
Mm.
But I don't think that bothered him as much as the fact that she wanted him to be an architect. And she also controlled him financially. He needed money. He was a very footloose, crazy young writer. He dropped out of college. He went to New York City. He followed a lover to New York, to the East Coast. He wanted to be a writer. He didn't want to work. And she had enough money to send him $100 or $150 a month, which was a lot of money in the 1930s, right? Mm-hmm. So he had to write to her every week or every other week and say, I'm looking for a job, I'm going to go back to school, so that he could get the money out of her. Mm-hmm. Right, so that kind of push and pull is definitely
but this is all about control. Who controls who? And,
right.
And the little falcon wants to break free. It's very, very clear metaphorically. There's no question about what's going on. And it's even obviously Oedipal in the poem.
Yeah.
Was he self-conscious about that in this poem? That it was such an obvious psychodrama for him?
I think that Duncan really appreciated the human capacity for psychodrama. He really did appreciate Freud's work and the sense that our unconscious lives control us. So I think that this kind of confessional poem, I think that he enjoyed it, mm-hmm. you know. But I do think that you need to look at this poem for the other kind of subtext of the Vietnam War.
Yeah, let's talk about that. I didn't quite, even the second and third time I've read that poem, I didn't quite see it. So what is the subtext?
Well, I think the she is America, and he is reading Blake at this point. Mm-hmm. He is reading America. And I think that the falcon is the kid in the airplane. And, you know, and you see it at the end of the second stanza.
She lets me ride to the end of her curb, where I fall back in anguish. I dread that she will cast me away, for I fall, I mistake, I fail in her mission.
That word mission there really stands out to me.
And the little falcon is being trained to go kill, basically.
Right,
exactly. And to bring back living birds, smaller birds, helpless animals.
And to kill for someone else's will, not for his own, mm-hmm. right? Right, he's not allowed to do anything with the kill.
So if we're reading this as a poem in the context of the Vietnam War, the young falcon tears at his mother's wrist. He draws blood. He doesn't necessarily kill her, but to break free, he does violence to her.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think he intended that as a clear message beyond them? One must resist at all costs what's happening in Vietnam? Is that what the implication is? Is that just too literal?
Well, it's not so much that it's too literal. It's that I think it's pointing in a little bit of a different direction, I think. What Duncan sees it as a cosmic battle. He sees good and evil as always being in the picture.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of bloodshed, I think he sees as, it's just part of how the world works. So he protests the war, right? And he tries to do what he can to be active, you know, as an activist, not as a poet. But he doesn't think that the war is going to end because of his activity.
So this is one of Robert Duncan's best-known poems. Is it a false lead into his poetry? Does it characterize his other poetry very well?
It doesn't characterize his other poetry very well. Mm-hmm. But Duncan does a lot of different things. So you do see work like this within the big picture, but this is an unusual poem for Duncan. And I think it's an easier read. Duncan,
he's not always easy.
He's not easy, and he's not read because of it, I think, partly.
But you recommend him.
Oh, yeah. It's poetry that keeps giving back to you. The more you stay in it, the more you get from it. There's so much there. It's entering a world. There are a lot of adventures inside of there.
Lisa Jarno, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Lisa Jarno's biography is called Robert Duncan, the Ambassador from Venus, and it's published by the University of California Press. You can read some of Lisa Jarno's own poems, as well as a generous sampling of poems by Robert Duncan, on our website, poetryfoundation.org. If you want to go on a Duncan bender, get hold of the collected late poems and plays, and the collected essays and other prose, also published by the University of California Press. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.